This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So tonight we are continuing our study of the Eightfold Path, and we're going to look at right action. So just to summarize what we've done so far, so we started with the Four Noble Truths, and then we looked at right understanding and right thought, or right intention, which are both part of the wisdom aspect of the path. And then last time we met, we looked at speech, right speech, and tonight, right action, and next we'll do right livelihood, which are part of the Shila, or the sort of morality aspect of the path. And then finally, effort, meditation, and concentration, which are part of the samadhi aspect of the path. So I was just thinking that right action is sometimes referred to in Western Buddhism, or used kind of synonymously with social action. And so tonight let's look at what it means specifically from within Buddhism, and see why that connection or that correlation might be made. So what I'd like to do is just sort of reiterate, go over some of the things that texts that we've been looking at brought out, depending on which of those texts you're studying, and then open it up. So a right action literally means correct ends of actions. So the correct conclusion of an action, we might say. And so action within the spheres of activity, thinking, speaking, and acting with our bodies, action is especially significant because it is so impactful. It arises from desire and volition, and so it is karma. It can be accompanied by speech, but action itself is very powerful, just as a force. And so in a way, it's suggesting or asking us to really reflect on and appreciate how powerful it is to have a physical body in a physical world, and how we are then in our physicality continuously interacting with, relating to other physical bodies, people, inanimate objects, living creatures, and so on. And in those interactions, there's direct contact in a way that is very physical. And so in that way, it is one of the most significant ways in which karma is created. Because with our actions, we can physically change the world, and do. We can physically affect other people's lives, and do. And so I think it was Piyadasi Thera talked about it as right action is a way of molding the character, molding character. And he talked about it as the mental, physical, and moral qualities of a person. And that it's right action is a way that we can give fearlessness, which is something that the teachings speak of, the Buddha spoke of, and it's a very powerful thing to think of it that way in terms of how we interact with each other, that we can give fearlessness and trust calmness. And to think of molding the character, you know, we understand that what we do, how we, as Zadaroshi used to often say, combust our lives, is not separate from how we perceive ourselves and how other people perceive us. And so in that sense, we are creating every day and every moment this sense of self to the degree that we believe in that, that we are based in that belief, and in the same way creating that for others. But we shouldn't think of character as being anything solidified or intrinsically real, just as everything else is not intrinsically real. And yet it has characteristics, right? So when we talk about the character of a person, right, that means something to us. And that means it's a reflection of what that person, how that person is in the world, how they use their body, their words, and their mind. And so, as is true with all of the Eightfold Path, we can either be using these instruments, our understanding, our intentions, our speech, our actions, our work, and so on, in a way that creates more and more karmic bondage, more suffering, less stress, less calmness, more fear, or we can be doing something very differently. And that is, of course, the purpose of the path. And so with this body in mind, and we really need to understand it as one thing, one reality. This body can't be separated from the mind or the mind from the body. That we're trying to cultivate a cessation of creating harm, of aggression, of hatred, of all of the things that we do that hurt ourselves and others, basically, that create that very bondage. And at the same time that we're trying to diminish those ways of being, that we're trying to bring forth actions, in this case, that are more characterized by loving kindness and compassion and patience and generosity, that are building confidence, humility. And in that way, our physical being becomes a force. I mean, it's a force on either side of the scale, but a force for good, a force for inspiration, for being an example, for encouraging. And so Piyadasi quotes the Buddha who said, when thought is unguarded, then our bodily actions also will be unguarded, and so too our words and our mental activities. The Buddha says, a foolish person is known by their actions, and so too is a wise person. We know one another, in essence, by our actions. You know, I remember a mother of a girlfriend I had in high school who sometimes, in fits of frustration, would say, do as I say, don't do as I do. And I always remember thinking, really? You really think that's gonna fly? The Buddha said, by conduct, our knowledge, our wisdom is made bright. And so he's talked about these three qualities that that we can bring forth with our behavior, our speech, and our thoughts. And those qualities are those that right action is speaking to. So right action is right, is not killing, not stealing, and not misusing sexuality. And so we'll get into each of those. But first, why do you think the Buddha defined right action with those three? So in early Buddhism, there are the 10 unwholesome actions, which are those three, and harsh speech, divisive speech, trivial or idle speech, false views. We have the 10 bodhisattva precepts, which the first three of which are not killing, not stealing, and not misusing sexuality. But why do you think he defined it as those three? Why not harsh speech and divisive speech? Why not clouding the mind, right? Which is also one of the unwholesome actions. Why did he present it as just these three? I mean, we're just sort of conjecturing for the moment, right? But in terms of a way of perhaps gaining insight into what are the importance of these three, and why did he speak of define right action in this way? So I'll defer to the ones who have the mics. Cheerio.
These three are directly affecting another through this action is, I mean, I guess it affects the self too, so non-killing of self. Mm-hmm. But, you know, clouding your own mind is something that you're doing basically to yourself, and then mm-hmm. that will affect how you mm-hmm. act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But these three, you're saying, if I understand, you yeah. sort of put you in direct contact
yeah.
with others. Okay. Anybody?
Kind of like instinctual to being part to being an animal. I mean, it's like very basic to mm-hmm. survival. Mm-hmm. You know.
You mean we have to kill, we have to steal, and we have to misuse sexuality?
In our evolution, we might have. I mean, you know, up to this point in time, we're getting to the point, maybe, uh-huh. with the evolution of consciousness, and working together as a collective, mm-hmm. we may not have to anymore. Mm.
So, right, we don't have to. I mean, that, in essence, has been true all along. But, okay. Anybody else?
Mm. Possibly just the magnitude of those three. You know, I guess a silly way to look at it, but if you gave me a choice of divisive speech or stealing,
mm-hmm.
I would choose divisive speech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe just the magnitude of that and of what you...
I don't know. Maybe the quantity or quality of karma that you create from those just has a... Well, it's different, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about that. The authors speak about how to sort of judge the weight of an action and the different elements that are part of that, which I think are, you know, interesting to examine and question, even. And also, in right speech, is included divisive and harsh speech, right? And so, in essence, those have already been addressed in the previous factor of the Eightfold Path. But still, I think it's just an interesting sort of line of inquiry as to why these three figure so prominently.
Like what Simon said, I just think these are the karmic
heavyweights, that there's, you know, there's a karma of thought, there's the karma of speech, there's the karma of action.
Mm-hmm.
And these are loud.
Right. Right, so obviously we can do harm with our thoughts. We harm ourselves quite a bit with our thoughts. And we all know the experience of having hurt others and being hurt by words. Actions are, you know, in a sense, can be of a different order, right? Because the hurt is direct and physical, right? And can be ultimate in that sense. You know, in the sense that we can actually take someone's life away.
There's kind of a feeling that somehow the three of them could be all-encompassing, or like that they could include everything, and I can apply it more to killing, because killing could be quite literal, or it could be like small deaths mm-hmm. all the time of mm-hmm. like taking something from somebody else, mm-hmm. taking like a small life in some mm-hmm. type of way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as sure about the, mm-hmm. the latter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you could also look at just in terms of how we could think about these in terms of their interpenetration, that in taking the life, you're stealing that life away. in taking the life, you're taking away that person's ability to have, you know, a full life, which would include sexuality, you know, a relationship, intimate relationship. So, okay. So, Bhikkhu Bodhi says that the pivotal element in this, in right action, is the mental factor of abstinence. Now, again, he's speaking from a Theravadan perspective, even though he is very well versed in Mahayana teachings. And abstinence is not so much that we talk about in the Zen tradition, you know, in terms of, but if we think of it in terms of to abstain, right, to abstain from killing, to abstain from stealing, to abstain from misusing sexuality, to restrain ourselves from indulging, you know, so we, in essence, we're striving to get to the point where we're no longer in conflict, right? We're no longer struggling to not do those harmful actions, right? And to be at the point where that struggle is really, has been, in a sense, won, you might say, right? Where we're no longer competing within ourselves, with those forces within ourselves, but more that we have really, you know, calmed or seen through, realized, and so are more integrated in our ability to live the way we aspire to. Along the way, where we use abstaining a lot, right? We use restraining ourselves a lot from speaking or acting or even thinking, you know, indulging thoughts that we know are harmful or are working against our aspirations. And so he says that that element of abstaining is pivotal. And so we might think of that as an aspect of the path, that in the beginning we really do have to practice a lot of restraint because we want to go so often. We want to go in this direction, right? But the precepts or the teachings or just our own sort of other half, other part, understands is trying to, you know, develop ourselves in a different way. But that ultimately, you know, we want to be moving and cultivating, you know, ourselves so that we're not in a constant state of conflict and struggle. Okay, so now looking at the first of these, which is not killing, let's just look at what the Buddha said. So the Buddha said, herein, to abstain from the taking of life. Herein, someone avoids the taking of life and abstains from it. Without stick or sword, conscientious, full of sympathy, one is desirous of the welfare of all living beings. So to abstain from killing. And, you know, as Jana said, we can think of this, and indeed, in our understanding of the precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts, we do want to look at each of these precepts in terms of their traditional meaning, and the traditional meaning of this precept is to not take human life, and then other forms of sentient life, and then to look at that in a more expansive way of all the ways in which we can kill or take the life away from small deaths, as you said. And so to abstain, and he says the taking of life, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi, says the taking of life is to be avoided, is intentional killing. That is to be avoided, is intentional killing. The deliberate destruction of life of a being endowed with consciousness. And so remember that, because this is all based in the understanding of karma, right, as being a force, the sort of the sort of principal force in terms of creating suffering and binding ourselves further in that suffering for ourselves and others. And so the intention is, you know, pivotal in our actions, because that's what's establishing the sort of the direction of the action, which is based in our mind, our consciousness, our desires, our attachments, our views, the whole package. And so he says what we're trying to avoid is intentional killing, intentional stealing, intentional misuse, any intentional action which is hurting life or hurting another person or hurting ourselves, right? And beyond or besides just the, looking at it from the point of view of creating karma, why is that so important, right? The difference between doing something unintentionally and intentionally. I mean, in a sense, it's, we might think it's self-evident, but for that reason, let's articulate. Why is that so important?
I'm trying to remember where it was. In the sense of awareness, my own awareness, or anyone else's awareness, or an animal's awareness, that sense of self, as it were, not defined, but just awareness, is, to me, it's sacrosanct. And to destroy that sense of a being's only moment of experiencing existence, its awareness, is the intention of doing that precedes the actual doing it. And so in order to kill another being, you have to kill the being, kill the being's consciousness in your mind.
Right. And so looking at it from the point of view of a person on the path, for you as the person who has that intention to take a life versus taking a life without that intention, what's the difference there in terms of you as a person of the path? Where does that put you?
On the path, I kill the person first.
But I mean in terms of your consciousness, what's the difference in your consciousness, in your state of being, between having that intention to take life and not having the intention?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's a prior experience of killing. And for my consciousness, it just eliminates that being, that consciousness, which I share in an awareness, just having that awareness. So I preserve the awareness for myself, but am willing to destroy the awareness that some other being has. And on the path, that's a massive destruction. An accidental running over a squirrel is, I beep for squirrels, but sometimes they just go back and forth and under the tires. And I say, I'm sorry, but I didn't do it intentionally. I didn't kill it in my mind first.
Okay. All right. Anybody else in terms of that role of intention? Because remember, in these readings, there, a couple times the authors talked about the weight of an action. You know, so it's not just the action itself, but other elements that go into.
Reading this, I start thinking about what a sentient being actually is. And in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, he mentions, I think he phrases it, humans, creatures, and insects are all considered sentient beings, but he specifically mentions plants are not. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, I mean, we know a lot more about plants now than we did, you know, 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. But, You know, so I guess my question is, you know, what is a sentient being or bacteria? I mean, we brush our teeth. We kill millions of them every time mm-hmm. we brush our teeth. Mm-hmm. And or if you're a vegetarian and you cut some vegetables from the garden intentionally. I mean, maybe I'm splitting hairs, but, you know, I mean, something has to die today so we can live.
Yeah. I don't think you're splitting hairs. You know, I think when the way the Buddha spoke of it was that it included all human life. And that in terms of consuming animals for food, that for monastics, I don't know if it was the same for lay, but if an animal is killed expressly to feed the monastic, that was not, then they would violate taking life. If it was not expressly killed for the monastics, then it was okay. And I think, again, it has to do with the intention.
The intention is where the separation first occurs. And if I'm intending harm on someone, I don't even have to do it. I've already made the cut mm-hmm. and, in a sense, elevated myself. And I mean, I think it's basically what mm-hmm. Mokudo was saying, mm-hmm. but just in a different way of framing it, that at that moment that I even want someone else to feel pain, even if I feel like, you know, justified in it in some way, that's a separation that I've created, that mm-hmm. that is a mm-hmm. a death of our interdependence.
Yeah. I mean, if you yes, that's all true. I mean, if you really put yourself, maybe you've had that thought before, you know, of being so what that you wanted to take somebody's life. Angry. I mean, we're talking about a very, very potent state of consciousness that is body, that is mind, that is emotion, that is destroying, right? That's not a, you know, an abstract thing. That's like an explosion waiting to happen. So in terms of the power of that, you know, again, this is all, you know, we're speaking to practitioners, right? People who are wanting to walk this path. And so to get to that place, right, means that didn't just happen in that moment, right? That is a path that has been cultivated, right? And that's exactly what we're trying to transform, right? To not get to that place. And so to think about, you know, because when we talk about it, intention can sound, you know, we understand what it means, but it can sound kind of distant. But if we actually have that desire, you know, we're in a very particular state in that moment.
Do you think it's always anger specifically? I mean, I feel like that intention could, you know, conceivably come from fear or your own hurt. Or, you know, something that might sound more innocent mm-hmm. in when you're saying it to yourself, mm-hmm. and yet is just as powerful mm-hmm. as anger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and again, to think in terms of degrees, that, you know, to whatever we might be feeling, you know, that if I want to, in reaction to that, hurt you, right? There's a whole gradation of hurt, you know, that is going to match or be equal to what the gradation of what I'm feeling, right? And so this is the consciousness that we are examining, right? And trying to revolutionize, right? So then he goes on to talk about the positive aspect of taking life, of course, is affirming life. He speaks of it as the development of kindness and compassion. So rather than destroying life, we want to actually give life. We want to bring life forth. Rather than diminishing or injuring, we want to support it, nurture it.
Does the intention nearly indelibly like stain your consciousness. That's what it kind of sounds like. Like that type of intention is so powerful that then it becomes you in a way.
Well, it, like everything else, is conditioned, which means it's dependent upon, you know, a complex system. We call it ourselves and our lives. It arises in a moment, let's say, when we're aware of it or it's being expressed, and then at some point it passes, right? So it's not, there's nothing permanent about it. And it is not, it, because it's dependent on different influences, it doesn't exist on its own, right? We are collaborating. When I talked on Sunday about thinking of karma as personal, and then I said I've been thinking of it more in terms of collaborative rather than collective, because it creates a sense of actively working together. We could think of ourselves as collaborating within ourselves with our different desires, impulses, you know, beliefs and ideas, and that's what we're trying to see and examine, because without mindfulness, without self-awareness, that is happening, but we don't tend to notice it. But it comes and it goes, right, as all things do. And so it's not you, that intention, and yet it arises from what we call your consciousness, right, which we say is yours or we say is mine because it's arising in this body and mind. And so it's my responsibility. That's the personal part. The collaborative part of it is that everybody's had a hand in it, right? But how I have, you know, if I'm the soup and there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, you know, how I sort of have put this soup together, if you will, is something that is collaborative, and yet is in every moment I am, you know, the sort of the continuity, you know. And so intention is, for that reason, so important, because it's also, because really it's just the think of it as the expression of a desire. And the desire is just an expression of what we think's going on, of how we think things work. So the desire comes out of my understanding of what I want and how I'm going to get it, right? So if I want peace or equanimity or attention or, you know, warmth or food or whatever, you know, in terms of what my innermost desires are or needs, the desires that arise from that is to fulfill those innermost, deepest existential yearnings is based in my understanding, and that's going to become my desire and then my intention. And that is creating karma, right? Which feeds back and strengthens all of that. And the other reason intention is so important and powerful is because it's a way that we can access those deepest parts of ourselves, right? Through our thoughts, through language, right? In other words, we can bring forth an intention to cultivate compassion even when we don't feel compassionate, right? We can bring forth an intention to be patient in a moment where we're not patient, right? And we may believe more in the reason for our impatience than we do in the reason to be patient. But we're practicing bringing forth and strengthening that desire to be patient because we have faith in it, right? And so that gives us an incredible kind of access, because without that, what? I mean, without that, we sort of have to wait until it's there, right? Until we feel it, until it's more embodied within us. And what intention does is gives us a way to honestly enter in, you know, through sort of the easiest access point, which is our thoughts, because that's where we live so much of the time, but to use them now in a different way. Consciously, one, that's a big change, and then in a way that's actually in alignment with the path and the teachings, which, if we have faith in them, is what we want. Right? So it's not just subscribing to somebody else's idea, but that it's something that we actually believe in. We have faith that it is how I want to live. You know, we have faith that there's truth in it.
I have a question about what the realm of consequences is. I'm working with Piedasi Terra's book, and he seems to emphasize both a very sort of individual working of mm-hmm. karma, mm-hmm. and at the same time, a very kind of far-reaching sphere of consequences, where your own volitional actions will lead to your health mm-hmm. or your what I would consider your worldly mm-hmm. circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think what I would tend to think is that, you know, the more volitional individual mm-hmm. things, you know, operating more in the realm of conduct building character. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's like if when you were talking about action, it's sort of like murder versus manslaughter type mm-hmm. of situation. Mm-hmm. In term, I can see how one intentional action will have very different consequences in my conduct building my character. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the broader sphere of consequences, how is it that the manslaughter situation with, keeps you from bringing about some terrible consequences?
Well, I don't know that it keeps you from that, because I mean, I would think that any conscious, caring, compassionate person would be deeply distraught to have caused the death of someone, whether it was, even if it was accidental. So it's not that because it wasn't their intention that they're not affected. I would think I would be affected for the rest of my life, right? And in ways I can't even imagine. And so, but it's, remember that in terms of Buddhism and the path and working on this path of liberation and how karma is either creating more and more burden. And so when we talk about karma, it's not just, because everywhere around us there is cause and effect, right? In the human realm, in the animal realm, in the plant realm, and, it's how things are interacting and changing. But what Buddhism is concerned about is consciousness, right? And how our actions, in a sense, weigh in our consciousness in such a way that they're arising from and then further strengthen and compound aspects of our consciousness that are suffering, right, and binding. And then we spread that around, versus transforming that so that we're not living that way. We're not creating those kinds of actions, so we're not so burdened. And others around us are not so burdened, right? That our lives actually are more joyful and happy and of benefit. You know, that we're actually doing what every religion says is possible to do, right? Which is to create a kind of peace on earth. And so that's the particular concern in terms of cause and effect in Buddhism. And that's why intention is so important. It doesn't mean that unintentional actions will have no effect. They have an effect, and they might have serious impact on our, person. But just think about it. I mean, if you were that person who had done something and you had intended to do it, versus it being accidental, I mean, on either side, there's going to be a heavy load to carry, but I think admittedly, you know, it would be different, right? I think that's that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, but still, I am, I don't really understand where he's, I mean, I have my own assumptions, but where he's coming from when he says that, that really your situation, you know, your... is the cause of your volitional actions.
Yeah. So this is, you know, a basic teaching of karma in Buddhism. And, it, you know, I've talked about this a lot because it's something I've really thought about a lot and talked to other teachers and scholars and have struggled with, right? Because it because of the very explicit ways that sometimes that is presented, that someone's, you know, misfortune in this life, or their bad circumstances, or their physical challenges, you know, just in terms of mental health, in terms of physical, you know, deformities, that those in Buddhism are seen as karmic fruits of past lives. So what do we do about that? Right, because I think it's particularly in our time, it's so we can see how hurtful, you know, that could be in terms of blaming people. You know that you're guilty, you're responsible for your bad circumstance, and then also in terms of, you know, a society, you know, the collaborative aspect in terms of what is a family, a nation's, a group, a society's responsibility towards any individual or any group of individuals who are not, don't have advantages, you know, within that society. It can very easily let that society off the hook. And I think that is how it's been used. And it's in Christianity too. You know, it's framed in a different way. But I think it may be, I don't know if it's in all religious traditions, but it seems to show up again and again, you know, that what you're experiencing now, I mean, it's in a very simple way, you know, like if you're struggling, it's just because you're not working hard enough, right? That's the American dream. It's just another version of the same thing. And so, and it's a way of, and you know, the people who say that are never the people who are struggling. They may have struggled, right? But now they're not struggling. And they make it sound as though they did this on their own. So in that way, I think it's a dangerous aspect of the Buddha Dharma. Now, I'm not perfectly enlightened, far from it. And so are there aspects of karma that I don't understand? Yes. Yes. And so are there ways in which there could be truth to that teaching and it not being used to sanction or to blame in that way, perhaps? So, you know, as I've said before, I just, you know, hold that in an open hand. You know, I don't present that as a teaching, as something that I think we should all subscribe to, because one, I don't know that it's true. It's not in my experience on that level. And but at the same time, I don't know that it's not true, right? But I feel like when it's brought up, it needs to be brought up with some cautions, you know? I don't know how satisfying that is, but... I mean, you know, this is a very, very old tradition. It goes way back. And on the one hand, you know, the Buddha's enlightenment seems to be continually confirmed, you know, in so many ways, you know, by modern, you know, fields of investigation. And at the same time, there are things that about his enlightenment and what he spoke of as his direct experience that really demand, that stretch my capacity to conceive of and imagine, and, you know, and so is that an aspect of my own limited experience? Yes, I know that's true. And imagine that will always be true. Does that mean that all of those things are categorically true? I don't know. I don't know. So. Okay, so shall we look at stealing? So the Buddha said, herein, abstaining from taking what is not given. So one avoids taking what is not given and abstaining from it. What another person possesses of goods and chattel in the village or in the woods, that one does not take away with thievish intent. So again, there's the presence of intention. So why, with the understanding that attachment is dukkha, is suffering, possessiveness, right, is attachment, and that all things are empty, why so much concern about taking what doesn't belong to you?
Well, it's based in a deluded view, first of all. So,
what's the deluded view?
That the thing that I'm going to take is going to satisfy me, mm-hmm. And bring me contentment and peace and happiness. Mm-hmm. It's feeding greed. Mm-hmm. So it's confirming and feeding one of our most poisonous tendencies. Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to relieve you, though, of your possessiveness.
But see, you're not.
Why?
Well, because if you really had my well-being in mind, you would take a very different approach in terms of relieving me of my possessiveness. Perhaps you would begin by teaching me the Dharma, for example, mm-hmm. rather than by taking mm-hmm. my cattle. Mm-hmm. I might not get it, you know, and then I also don't have milk or beef or whatever for my village.
I remember just when you said that, I was remembering when we were in India on our pilgrimage, and in so many, everywhere we went, you know, we'd see cows and bulls walking through towns, through cities, and I asked Tosan at one point, I said, where do all of these live? And he said, "Oh, they all have homes, you know, like somebody owns them, and they just go out wandering during the day, and then they'll go back and get fed." It was like, "Really? That's crazy." But what else, if I were to steal, yeah. right? What else is like in what? What else am I ignoring? Or what else is true? Right, that makes that a not right action. I mean, all that you said is true, but what else is true?
What letter does it start with?
What?
I said, what letter does it start with?
Okay, all right, touche. Valid answer. I would be ignoring the convention that we have possessions. That's a convention that we agree upon, right? That you have things that you use, I have things that I use. We say that those things belong to us, right? And that is a convention that we use, right? And so to steal that under whatever pretense, right? So let's say it's some sort of, you know, distorted dharma stupidity, right? I'm ignoring conventional reality, right? So think of Yasutani's time, place, position, degree. That's saying that we have an agreement in our society that we won't do that, right? And that seems to be true in most societies. Well, I don't know if that's true. But in ours it is. And so then I am violating that. I'm not only in terms of, you know, my own delusion, but also that I'm, you know, creating harm in that way. Who, Scrap, did you have the mic? Okay. You have to raise your hand if you want to.
So this is going to sound funny, but was Robin Hood wrong, stealing from the rich and giving to the poor?
From a Buddhist perspective, yeah, stealing. Now, let's look at, where is that section? And Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about the degree of moral weight that attaches to the action is determined by three factors. First of all, he sort of enumerates different kinds of stealing. So there's just stealing, which is taking the belongings of others secretly, as in housebreaking and pickpocketing. There's robbery, which is taking from others openly by force. There's snatching, very nuanced, suddenly pulling away another's possession before they have time to resist. There's fraudulence, which is through deception, and deceitfulness, which is using false weights and measures to cheat customers. So, but this degree of moral weight that attaches to the action is determined by three factors: the value of the object taken, the qualities of the victim. Uh-oh. Exactly. I mean, I'm just reading the book. And the subjective state of the thief. Okay. So
is that intention of the thief? Subjective state?
The first moral weight is directly proportional to the value of the object. So the greater the value, the greater the... And again, the moral weight is the karma, right? It's the weight of the burden, sort of the moral binding that is being created. So he says the moral weight is directly proportional to the value of the object. So might we understand that as the greater the value, the greater the greed? Regarding the second, the weight varies according to the moral qualities of the deprived individual. So in that sense, Robin Hood stealing from, you know, not nice people would have, I guess, a lighter karmic burden, but is still stealing. Huh?
He said it was from the rich. He's English. We're making an assumption that rich people are nice.
I just said a not nice person. Oh, because of Robin Hood.
Rich person.
Yeah. Okay. But I think in Robin Hood they're not nice, aren't they?
Both rich and not nice.
Yeah. Okay, you can work that out on your own time. And then the third is the act of theft may be motivated either by greed or hatred, and then he makes a distinction that if something is motivated by greed, then that's, you know, has its own consequence. That's an own in sort of internal weight. But if it comes from hatred, then he says, it's coming from more of a desire to harm, right? It's not just about the object, that we want to hurt this person, and that carries a greater weight.
The greater weight, oh, yeah.
A greater harm.
Well,
So the greater weight, what if Robin Hood feels no karmic, negative karmic energy? He's doing something with the right intention, for the right reason, and he walks away with no harm per se to himself in a karmic way. Is that a possibility?
Well, first of all, I'm not the
Robin Hood
adjudicator
right
here. I think, you know, bringing up these factors is pointing to the fact that there are different things present in a situation, right? And that rather than just sort of applying a rule and that every action is equal, it's really saying actions are not equal, right? Because they're contextual and they're, you know, there's things in terms of the actor and the acted upon and so on. I think that's what I take from this is the sort of salient point, is that we not, just think of this as the application of rules, and that's, you know, when we teach the precepts, I think we talked about this last time, that the different perspectives, you know, in terms of time, place, position, degree, in terms of understanding them literally from the Mahayana perspective, from the point of view of the absolute, and all of that is pointing to the fact that we live in a dynamic universe in which nothing is fixed, and all things are empty and impermanent, and there is, and it's a physical world in which there is cause and effect, and we impact on each other, and that is true. And we influence each other in ways that are positive and negative, helpful and not helpful. And that all of that together is what we are, I mean, that's what we are striving to understand and live within, that whole totality. Okay. That's great.
And because it is related, in the beginning about the not stealing, it relates to all of them that... my question is, it's about creating an entanglement, so it doesn't really, like, yes, we can define levels and degrees and, like, mismatched things that will come back in some other way lifetimes from now. Mm-hmm. But specifically with the Robin Hood question, not only is he or whoever creating an entanglement, they're claiming that they know what's right within the natural order of things. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit problematic. But in my question of these challenges, it's really difficult to do anything at all.
To do anything?
To do anything at all. Because it seems that no matter what...
I would say it's difficult not to do anything.
Both ways, yes. But kind of in that question of disturbing.
But the fact is because... we have this body and mind and our thoughts and our words, we are doing something all the time. And so better to do it awake than not, better to do it with one eye open than both eyes closed, right? So to whatever degree we are acting out of more clarity, more understanding, more compassion, that's good, right? And so if we don't think in terms of absolutes, but that, I mean, this is what happens when each of us begins thinking about, you know, in a conscious and heartfelt way about what it means that we are alive and it's happening. We're in the middle of it. And we're being influenced and influencing others, and we reflect on our lives, you know, how has it been up till now? How have I been doing? You know, and we are more and more aware of what we're doing today. That, you know, when we talked earlier, I think, about atonement, you know, we have to really learn how to hold our transgressions and at the same time, and our confusion and our lack of clarity, at the same time that we're trying to liberate that, because we're acting today, right? We're creating karma today. We're interacting, we're influencing others, and so we can't wait. It's live. So let's look at the third, abstaining from sexual misconduct. So the Buddha said, one avoids sexual misconduct and abstains from it. They do not have intercourse with such persons as are still under the protection of the parents, brothers, sisters, people who are unmarried, or no, not with married, those who are married, nor with convicts. That's true, actually. If you have intercourse with convicts, now it's a crime. It's considered rape. Yeah. Because, yeah. And even if it's a consensual... even if it's consensual?
I think the law considers it...
Because it can't be consensual because of the power differential. Yeah.
Are you talking about inmates or convicts?
Convicts. Imprisoned people. People who are in prison. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi says the guiding purpose of this precept from the ethical standpoint is to protect marital relations or committed relationships from outside disruption and to promote trust and fidelity within the marital union. He goes on to say the principle does not, however, confine sexual relations to the marital union. It's flexible enough to allow for variations depending on social convention. So I think that's a nod to today. You know, that we are in a time that has very different sexual, you know, mores and views of everything, or of many things. He says the essential purpose is to prevent sexual relations which are hurtful. You know, so when the precept of not misusing sexuality is that's exactly what it means, is not to use sexuality in a way that is hurtful. And so again, if we think of this in terms of right action and the karma that is created through misusing sexuality, through harmful sexuality, right, our world is replete, right, with examples of this everywhere. And in a way, it's taking, I think of it as taking what I talked about in the beginning in terms of having a physical body. You know, I mean, killing is a certain kind of killing, right? But it's in sexuality, there is the assumption or the hope or the pretense of intimacy, the exact opposite, right? And so when that is used in an opposite way, not towards intimacy, but towards hurting, right? It's such a form of harm.
I have kind of a general question. Maybe it's a bit sidetracking, but I was wondering about the karmic weight of intentions that aren't acted upon, both intentions that arise without examination, and then intentions that arise but are examined and are looked at and investigated.
And but are not acted upon?
In both cases, but are not acted upon.
And the question is, what is sort of the karmic effect of that? Well, how would you see that, given what we've been talking about in terms of, and just thinking in terms of the, you know, the weight of an action when it's in your mind versus when you give it voice versus when you act on it?
So I would think about it as ingraining certain paths within my own cognition, whereas certain intentions that are examined, that are brought into light and are seen for their unwholesomeness, then that's somehow disrupting those certain patterns. And
yeah, and so, and even if they're, so if they're, let's say they're harmful or negative intentions, to, you know, to have them in your mind, right, it's affecting you, right? And if we sort of indulge that in our mind, then it is to some degree strengthening that. But it's not the same as if we start acting on it. The danger of it is that we will start acting on it, right? Because there's a close connection between thought, speaking, and then acting. But if we don't, right, then it seems to, you know, have a lighter impact than if we actually start expressing it, right? And so in that way, you know, that's a way to responsibly work with our mind when we're still struggling and, you know, and it's still got a lot of energy. So we may have a lot of thoughts or have fantasies or, you know, and indulge them, But even if we're, you know, able to act less on them or speak less out of them, that's progress, right? Because it's we're containing it more. We're sort of holding it more within ourselves. And so then the consequence of that is not as great because it's more contained. And so that's, I mean, we should not discount the value of that, you know, as opposed to thinking that if you have one wayward thought, then all is lost. You know.
Okay. So in this Bhikkhu Bodhis book, he writes about it as very kind of concrete kind of rules for life, as you have like the Ten Commandments in Christianity. Mm-hmm. But if you read about right action in other texts, like Zen texts, it sometimes is written about it in a little bit more esoteric way, or kind of almost as in itself describing that kind of consciousness or describing the enlightened mind as aspects, as these as aspects of it. Mm-hmm. So sort of then abstaining, then, you know, going according to these rules is more of an approximation of that which is that enlightened mind, which has all these different aspects, and that those be aspects of them.
Mm. I don't know. I'm not sure what you mean by approximation.
Mm.
You mean a manifestation?
I mean moving towards.
Moving towards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's sort of. I was reading in the Receiving the Marrow,
mm-hmm.
And one of the texts in which I found it to be a little bit more, in this way, kind of less interpreted as very like concrete rules,
mm-hmm.
Talking about like what is right as relational, which we talked about today, how it can be. From one context to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But that also means that there will be a situation where, well, according to this author, there could be a right action in stealing,
mm-hmm.
or in taking life. But that's kind of dangerous.
Yeah.
Or like, how can you talk about that? Because in a way, like, I get it. I can get that
mm-hmm.
perspective,
mm-hmm.
what they're pointing to.
Mm-hmm.
Which is more of a beyond that, I don't know.
Well, when I was talking before about the different perspectives with regards to the precepts as we teach them, that's what I was referring to. So the Mahayana perspective is that when necessary, out of compassion and reverence for life, to steal, do so. But it's not for oneself. It's not self-serving, right? It's not out of greed. It's not out of hatred. And so in that way, the precepts are not fixed rules, right? Because the world isn't fixed. Situations aren't fixed. And then the Bodhidharma One Mind precept is looking at it from the point of view of the absolute, that even to give rise to the thought of stealing is creating duality in the mind. Self, other, object, cause, consequence. And so in that way, there are these, which, and so these are different ways of understanding them, and they're, in a sense, different ways. They're the ways that our practice progresses and we relate to and are embodying and living as that progresses, right? And so I talked about abstaining in the beginning as a very sort of hands-on, sort of literal, linear, you know, everybody can understand that. And based in sort of the sense that, you know, this desire has its own power, and so I need to really protect myself from it, right? Because my experience is though it's doing something to me, right? And it can take me in a direction I don't want to go. And so it's very much the sense of self and other, right? Even just in my thoughts. And then as we proceed and we see into that more and realize that that's not true, it's fundamentally empty. It has no inherent existence. It's completely collaborative, right? It's nothing but mind, right? Then it's not so much a matter of restraint, but it's just realizing that arising is like a cloud. Right? It appears in some way, but it's not what it appears to be. Okay, and then moving with each step towards more integration of what we call relative and absolute, right? Of emptiness and form. Okay.
So I'm still very much working with the abstaining, and for some reason it comes up often driving, just somebody slowing down, going too slow, the light changing at the wrong time, and the surge of anger from a simple thing like that that can come up. And there's a lot of recognizing it and then going to some practice or just to my breath or just awareness. Mm-hmm. And recently, sometimes doing something different than that. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how many times, you often talk about 1,000 times, however many times you come back to it. Mm-hmm. This first stanza from Equinox by Joy Harjo, our poet laureate, expresses this somewhat. I keep walking away, though it has been an eternity. I must not break into the story by force, for if I do, I will find myself with a war club in my hand, staggering towards the sun, your nation dead beside you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she's Native American, so
yeah,
she knows about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes the club comes in handy, but you have to use it well, right? Bloodlessly.
What would you do with it that would be using it well?
I mean, what I'm saying is sometimes we have to apply some force, some mm-hmm. energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, but we can do that without violence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But, since in those moments, and I think most of us have experienced those moments, so we've just got a certain, presumption about what's going on. So what if you just create a new presumption? Like maybe that person is in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they cut me off.
Mm-hmm.
Or, it may or may not be true, but what we're telling ourselves may or may not be true, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that could be another skillful means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a construction. It's sort of a device. But it can also, in that moment, it can help, if it's helpful, to see how easily something can shift when we just shift our perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, one is no more true than the other, as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But one may be more skillful than the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And
so if we're going to make something up,
mm-hmm.
first, make it up knowingly. And two, make it up in some way that it helps, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And then there's a point where maybe we don't have to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we should just, and not worried about when that point's going to come. Just stay with whatever we're practicing
right.
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Rowan? Oh, what's your son?
I'm thinking about...
Red.
I think I remember I read from which sutra say that
Hang on a second. I don't think we have juice going here.
We are thieves.
Thieves?
Yes. Like we take things from the earth, mm-hmm. like whatever you're vegetarians or mm-hmm. you're, we just take it,
mm-hmm.
And we think this is ours, this is mine, and mm-hmm. we just take mm-hmm. it. And I'm thinking about, right now the global warming and the every day the cattle and being killed, about 800,000 cattle being killed, and the cattle create burpings mm-hmm. that create the greenhouse mm-hmm. gas that's the number three to the global warming effect problems. And but we eat beef, we eat the dairy products mm-hmm. and we don't think that we killed this animal, right? Most of us we don't have that thought that we kill them because we need them. And so this kind of intention, this kind of knowing or unknowing, it's a problem. And I think we have to look deep into that. If we can eat this, or our government can create, can produce, or we can change the law to make action to change this and to change that crisis of this earth. And I think that's kind of actions, right actions, that we need to look into this.
Yeah, and so that's where you can see the relationship between right action and social action, right? Where an individual action becomes larger. Yeah. Rowan, maybe we'll finish here.
Testing. Okay. As somebody who's tends to lean pretty Marxist, you know, that group has its fair share of violence.
What group?
Marxist. That group has its fair share of violence. And they frequently have the perspective of violence as a political tool. And that can also fall into, like, killing. But they're pretty far on that. But it seems, I don't know, somehow reasonable to me that in certain circumstances, killing would be morally justifiable. And as we talked about previously, they're in Mahayana perspective, you know, their guidelines. There may be times that it is justified. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering how it related to, I don't know, political identity in that, like, I don't know, maybe like a strategic assassination of a terrible dictator, mm-hmm. because that is explicitly causing suffering, mm-hmm. like, amongst the world. And it's, you said earlier that that Robin Hood was weird because humans, you were making humans as the arbiter of values, I think, I think. That is how we function. We have to exist as at least moral arbiters in some regard if we're going to make basic functioning in everyday life.
We do. I mean, I think we can, you know, if we expand our consciousness and our field of concern to not just be those that are like us, whether it's our group or whether it's human beings or, you know, or just animals that we like cats. you know, in other words, to be wiser, you know. And I think that's going back to what I think Sancho was talking about in terms of plant life and what is being, you know, so much of the research that's been done in recent years about the animal world, the non-human animal world, and how, you know, much consciousness and emotion and loyalty and, you know, all of these characteristics that we attribute, that we have as human beings, and you know, that for years has been sort of off the table, not scientifically viable to propose that other living creatures exhibit any of those same qualities. And yet one author said, Carl Safran, said that just, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, it doesn't make sense that, you know, creatures without any of those qualities, you know, are all of the animals of the earth, and then suddenly humans appear with all of these emotions and, you know, relatedness. It's like, that just doesn't make sense, right? And I thought that was such a compelling argument, you know. And so, but because of that natural bias towards our own, and then using our own sort of instruments to define intelligence or emotion or value in other creatures or communication, when we just don't understand their language, we don't understand how they relate, and so we think it doesn't exist, right? Because we can't see it. And so I think that is part of our larger evolution as human beings, and how that's all going to play out in terms of what Jusan was talking about, and, you know, and how climate change and all of these different forces, as we actually understand more and more, and in a certain sense, at the same time, understand more and more how much we don't know, right? Because as we start to understand, for instance, about the animal world, how much more don't we understand, right? And so in a way, our continued development of wisdom is also increasing our awareness of our own ignorance, which is a good thing, because then maybe we'll act less presumptuously, you know, and with less arrogance, and more, maybe we'll listen more. Okay. Yosha? The last word.
I was looking at the 5 mindfulness trainings of the Order of Interbeing, and I like the way that, I guess it's Thich Nhat Hanh who wrote these, but how he expressed about refraining from harmful sexual action. He calls it true love. Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. Knowing that sexual desire is not love, and that sexual activity motivated by craving always harms myself as well as others, I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without true love and a deep, long-term commitment made known to my family and friends. Mm. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to protect couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. Seeing that body and mind are one, I am committed to learning appropriate ways to take care of my sexual energy and cultivating loving kindness, compassion, joy, and inclusiveness, which are the 4 basic elements of true love, for my greater happiness and the greater happiness of others. Practicing true love, we know that we will continue beautifully into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I think most of us would agree that true love is, you know, in a sense, the ultimate, an ultimate, or a very, very powerful force. But I think at the same time, you know, the reading of that seems to preclude that any other form of sexuality is creating harm, right? Without true love, which is committed. I mean, that was the language that you read.
Well, yeah, I think he says that sexual desire is not love.
Right. I understand that. Yeah. But it seemed to suggest that true love is equated, and not misusing sexuality is equated with a committed, ongoing relationship.
Sexual a sexual...
Not misusing sexuality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I think that needs to be examined, right? Because the times we live in are such that there's a great deal of sexuality that is taking place outside of true love and outside of a committed ongoing relationship. Is that automatically misusing sexuality? I don't know that that's true.
Have you talked to people who have swiped left, swiped right? You know?
More often than I ever thought I would.
Right. Right.
And it's a question. It's a question. I mean,
from my conversations, because I don't, you know, go on those sites, but I don't think that people are finding true love when, again, it goes back to intention, right? That they're motivated by sexual desire, let's say, rather than recognizing a whole human being, right?
Yeah, I understand. I just think it's a little black and white, right?
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, when these questions come to me, you know, first of all, you know, my job is not to direct people in terms, but they're asking me in terms of my understanding of the precepts and the right action and the Dharma, you know, the kind of questions I ask are, is there enough caring there of the person, right, that it is not hurting them, that you're not hurting each other, or one person is not hurting the other? And I've had conversations where there is no caring for the others, and I've said, I think that's misusing sexuality, right? Because you don't care about each other. And if you know that, even though you're in consensus about that, I don't know that that makes it good.
Right. It's not a crime according to the law or anything. We're talking about the Dharma. And we're talking about being on the path.
Right.
And what, you know, what is going to be aid you on the path.
Yeah, I guess my point is I just feel like true love is not the standard for what is not misusing sexuality, and anything, any sexuality where there's no true love is misusing it. I don't think that's true. I think we are capable of, I just don't think that's true. But that's just my opinion. And I don't have children that I have to take this up with. So I defer to the parental mind.
But it's also, it is Dharma, right? It's the karma that we're creating. We're trying to, you know, be on this path.
Yeah.
And so when someone engages in an act that basically is not in keeping with the reverence of human life, which, you know, is degrading themselves or somebody else, it's just not conducive to being able to really sit down and be with your mind, right?
Yeah, I still think it's just my, I feel like to say yes or no is too stark, right? I think people and relationships and things that happen are too vast and varied to make a rule about that. So I choose not to. But, you know, in some of those conversations where two people do not care about each other, I said, also think about it in terms of what are you cultivating within yourself regarding relationship and the other, right? You know, and I think this is also where the moral weight, is this something that, you know, is a one-off? Is this something that is a way of relating and of being with people, right? Is this one's experience of relationship? So I think there, again, we could look at it in a little bit of a more of a nuanced way. You know, in terms of the people, you know, when people are kids, when I was young, and you're trying to figure stuff out, right? And you're exploring and you know, working with not a whole lot of stuff yet. You know, so that's where I would just keep it a little, personally, I'd keep it a little more open. So I think let's finish up, because we could go on with this, because that's the nature of the subject. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Would somebody, can you lead us?
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.